Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Thursday, October 21st, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet itself. It's a simple PDF file to download and print it off, copy it, and use it as often as you'd like, absolutely free. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have been stepped through that worksheet process. And those files and the shows can serve as a tutorial for how to get the most benefit from this powerful process on a variety of issues. And you can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see a glowing heart icon. If you tap on that, it'll let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. And we hope people do that soon and often because it frequently leads to comments, questions, testimonials, and we're here to entertain those. Our call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, it'll put a little question mark by your phone number and I can announce you by your area code. Alternatively, you can send me an email at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, and or you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org, whyagain.org. And if we get those emails, we will address those questions and on the next available show, and then you can listen to the answers or discussion in the archive. We're also doing the Course in Miracles workbook lessons this year. Today is the 294th day of the year. Today's lesson simply reads, My body is a wholly neutral thing. And the essence of this is that the body is a tool for communicating and transporting us around the planet. It is not our essence. And that neutral thing doesn't see death because thoughts of fear are not invested there. And part of the lesson reads, my body, Father, cannot be your son. Your essence, my essence that you gave me, is not contained in the physical body, and so it doesn't wither and die. And what is not created in that way cannot be sinful nor sinless, neither good nor bad. Let me then use this dream of being in a body to help your plan that we awaken from all the dreams that we have made. And Pam Grout, in her Course in Miracles experiment lesson, titles this lesson 294 as a thought experiment. And she quotes James Corden, who said, a story only has the power you give it. So Pam writes, you're driving down the highway with Prince riding shotgun. You're innocently gazing at cornfields and windmills and a giant billboard advertising the world's largest prairie dog. You're having a fabulous time. How could you not be? You're hanging with one of the greatest musical artists of all time, one that everybody else thinks is dead. Suddenly, a red Corvette pulls in front of the car. You barely notice because you're singing Purple Rain at the top of your lungs. Prince, however, stops singing. He stiffens up. That car reminds him of the one-night stand that broke his heart, the one that inspired his famous 1983 hit, Little Red Corvette. Prince is thinking, why, that... The Red Corvette itself means nothing. It's wholly neutral, as Lesson 294 explains. Prince, if so inclined, can lay his story on it. He can see the Corvette through the lens of his date's promiscuity. You, on the other hand, only see a red car, period. Our bodies are like that red Corvette. They are wholly neutral. Without our stories, without thoughts of fear, like I need to schedule a mammogram or I forgot to take my Lipitor, yada, 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 our bodies serve as useful vehicles as long as they're needed. The American Medical Association would prefer to keep the course on the down low regarding this, but after they have served their purpose, which is to serve and give love, our bodies can be as easily cast off as putting down a sack of potatoes without sickness, aging, or pain. So that's the Course in Miracles lesson for today and the Pam Grout's Course in Miracles experiment commentary. And as usual, we've got about 50 minutes to take your comments, questions, testimonials, suggestions. We have, today's a Thursday, as I mentioned in the opening, and that means we've got a Mindshifter support group meeting available tonight. It is, it's at that time where it's 8 years that we've been doing this Thursday night support group. And all the information that you might need to join us in that group is available at mindshiftersacademy.org website. Please be advised that there's a separate login information for Tuesdays and Thursdays group. We had somebody else recently try to join the group on Tuesday using the login information for Thursday, and it was not successful. And in those groups, we usually have an hour of some type of lesson that we listen to, whether it's Michael Rice or Dale Allen Hoffman or Guy Finley or Ganga Ji or Byron Katie. And then we have time for doing worksheets or discussion. And we'd be happy to have you join us and or pass the information along to somebody that you think might benefit from joining. It's absolutely free, and if you have an internet connection, you probably have ready access. Again, all that information is available on MindShiftersAcademy.org website, and it's from 6:30 to 9 p.m. both the Tuesday and Thursday group. That's Central Time. And we'd be happy to have you join us. I was working with someone earlier today who was having a rough week and a half. And when we started looking at what might have been going on, what was perhaps a trigger for her, she was not able to think of anything. And I said, well, just slow it down and let yourself think about it. And the next thing you know, she stumbled across an incident that happened with her 17-year-old son. And it brought up a memory of a very unpleasant thing that happened when she was a teenager. And the entire session was then spent processing some of the hurts and fears and shames that are still residing in her as an adult in her 40s that had been there when she was a teenager and gotten triggered by interactions with her teenager and his friends today or a week and a half ago. And we just outlined several reality management worksheets that she can do to get access to how might this series of events that happened all those years ago have led to her downloading thoughts, beliefs, energies that are still in her system today. And when they get activated, they drive her life experience. They drive her emotions. If she's not able to catch it when it kicks in, they will drive her actions, her thoughts and words. And the startling thing for this very intelligent, high-functioning woman in her 40s is to think that she could have been so powerfully affected by something without even knowing it. And she left the session basically shaking her head with the awareness that for the past week and a half, all kinds of disruptions in her sleep pattern and her emotions and her interactions with her son have been driven by things that she downloaded when she was a teenager. And then, because they were unpleasant, emotionally painful, traumatic in nature, she found a way to block them from her conscious awareness and has been living her life pretending that those energies didn't exist in her. So that's some of the power that we have in this tool, the Reality Management Worksheet, to go in and uncover, okay, what is it that I'm carrying in me that just got resonated that's creating pain, fear, anger, sadness, hurt, mental, emotional turbulence in my life, and what can I do to become consciously aware of it and start dismantling its negative effects in my life? That's what we're offering with the Reality Management Worksheet. The awareness that every emotion I experience is created internally, and some of the awareness of exactly how that process works. So if you haven't, you know, if you're listening to this show and that sounds like a new concept to you, if you haven't tuned into it, we strongly encourage you to download the Reality Management Worksheet. It's absolutely free at whyagain.org. Download the worksheet, fill it out, and watch how it starts to change your awareness of the actual mechanisms that create the emotions you experience in your life. It's amazing how much easier our lives can be when we are more clear about and manage our emotional states and production. It is just amazing to me as I think back on how much better my life has gotten since applying these tools, how much more I get done in a day or a week or a month, how much more contentment I have in my life, how much more satisfaction I have in my life than I did before discovering these tools. And we are encouraging you to tap into the tools, apply them in your own life, and see whether or not the same can be true for you. And then if you do, give us a call. The call-in number is 563-999-3581. And if you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. What's on your mind? It makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work when people call and either ask a question or suggest a topic. And the intention we have with this work is to be of service. So how can we be of service to you? What is something that would be of benefit for you to spend the next 40 minutes discussing? 563-999-3581. I'll take this moment when no one has a hand up to suggest to you that if you know someone who struggles with reading difficulty, even if it's just that they read very slowly, or when they read, then they have a hard time remembering what they read, or somebody who has attention problems, or high anxiety or social anxiety, they might benefit from checking out what the tool that's available at Zing Performance, Z-I-N-G, performance.com. And it's rare that I promote something on any of my podcasts or interviews that costs money. It's rare. And this costs money, but this is not exorbitantly expensive, and this tool that they've developed has the potential to be highly beneficial. And it comes with a guarantee, and it has to do with a series of exercises that get tailored specifically to you when you take their neurological assessment. And these exercises have been demonstrated to improve the function of your cerebellum. And your cerebellum is directly related to far more physical and mental functioning than any researchers knew until just a handful of years ago. And what they've discovered is that if you specifically target exercises, and he said exercise is kind of a misleading word for this, but if you specifically target some trainings that challenge the cerebellum at the same time they exercise your vestibular process, your balancing process, this stimulates stem cell growth in the cerebellum. It actually increases the functioning of your cerebellum. And when that happens, everything that you do that has an automatic feature to it or function to it, like the pattern of moving your eyes across a page in a smooth fashion from left to right and then from the top to the bottom. Everything you do about remembering what you need to get ready to leave the house in the morning, the checklist of things that normally needs to be done, all of those things that many people do automatically, those of us who struggle with a cerebellum that is not high functioning have to do that consciously. And that puts an extra drain on the conscious part of our mind, on the frontal lobes. And the more we need to rely on the conscious awareness to focus to get things done, the more there's a drain on our mental emotional energy, the more stress we have, the more anxiety, the more difficulty concentrating, the more difficulty we have moving something from short-term memory to long-term memory. And so it's absolutely fascinating. And Winford Dore, D-O-R-E, is his name. And he wrote a book titled Stop Struggling in School. And the subtitle is The Secret Brain Reset for Children with Reading, Learning, or Behavior Problems. So the book, Stop Struggling in School, is available by Winford Dore, D-O-R-E. And the tool and the app that go on your iPad or your laptop or your desktop is available at zingperformance.com, Z-I-N-G, performance.com. So, we're here for comments, questions, topic suggestions. 563-999-3581 and press 1. What's on your mind today? I was talking to somebody else this week about the overlap between the 15 commitments of conscious relationship that I was working with and working through, reading some of those, and the correlation between those and some of the bottom line observations. And I read through the bottom line observations the other day, and you can download my own bottom line observations on the MindShiftersAcademy.org website. And I believe it's on the educational materials page. I'm checking that out as I talk or don't talk. Yeah, so the bottom line observations are there. The safety rating and observation list is there. The forgiveness worksheet pattern is there. My short version of the reality management worksheet is there. And the process for grief and loss is all there, absolutely free. I also put up Dr. Michael Rice's responsibility communication rules and the mind goal management sheet that was revised in 2017. So as I mentioned, the bottom line observations, rather than reading them again, I'll just let you know that if you want, you can download them free at MindShiftersAcademy.org website under the educational materials page. And before I move on with the 15 commitments of conscious leadership, I would just like to remind you that the thing that has really taken my work to the next level several different times is this tendency that I have to look for the similarities between great teachings, good teachers, etc., rather than highlighting the differences and trying to argue about who's right or who's wrong or which technique works better. Because my experience has been that it's never a one-size-fits-all, and some people are going to be more comfortable using the worksheets that Brandon Bays has, or that Byron Katie has, or the Sedona Release Method has, or they're going to, some people are going to be more comfortable using a technique like Ho'oponopono. And others are going to really enjoy Dr. Michael Rice's reality management worksheet and his three early memories of conflict and getting the stress you need, the mind goal management sheet from the Getting the Stress You Need workshop. So I thought I would talk a little bit about the commitment of integrity. And one of the things that happened, it still happens, but it really happened very powerfully back about, oh, I'll say 10 or 11 years ago. In the community of people that were working with Dr. Rice's tools at that time when this internet show was going and the Heartland Intensive Center was up and running, there were a lot of people involved in the work that had anger issues. And one of the things that was a real powerful teaching interaction for me was how many people would get really angry when somebody, themselves or somebody else, didn't live up to a commitment that they made. And it served as a platform for me to share some of the most useful things I've learned over the years about making commitments and breaking commitments, et cetera, and how I could integrate that with my own observation and my own experience with how unproductive it is for me to operate from anger. And it was difficult for a lot of these people because they would get so triggered when either they or somebody else made a commitment and then didn't follow through with it, that the anger would carry the day for them. And I would counsel or recommend releasing the anger or doing worksheets on the anger, and these people would brush that aside and want to hammer either on themselves or the other person with negativity for not having lived up to the commitment, and try to pressure or force or manipulate somebody to live up to a commitment that they may have decided they didn't want to do anymore. Or they had decided it wasn't the right time for them to do it. They were going to delay it because of other factors in their life. So why do I do that? And how can I have an experience where I make a commitment to do something and then I fail to follow through on that commitment? And how can I have that experience and learn from it without anger? Learn from it without beating myself up or downloading a bunch of trauma energy or negative thoughts about myself? Well, the answer for me is that it is literally found in an earlier commitment from the 15 commitments. And the second one in the list says, I commit to growing in self-awareness, and I commit to regarding every interaction as an opportunity to learn. Well, in this case, my making a commitment and then either failing to live up to it or choosing to not do it and changing my mind is an opportunity to learn. It's an event. It's an interaction with myself and the world or myself and the self. So especially if we have people who routinely make commitments and then don't live up to them, which was happening quite a bit within the community back about 11 years ago here in the Mind Shifters Radio community. What I recommend is that people take a step back, take that calming breath that I talk about so much, comfortably fill my lungs, hold it for a count of two or three, and then resist the exhale so the exhale is a nice, long, slow process of 10 seconds or more. And then turn the focus inside and then start having this curiosity that is recommended in the 15 Commitments of Conscious Relationship. Ask wonder questions, all kinds of questions about, well, I wonder what was going on with me when I agreed to make this commitment? And was I actually making the commitment because it was in line with my values and priorities and goals and desires to achieve? Or was I making that commitment because I didn't want to be the only one in the group who didn't make it? Or because I thought it would raise my status in the group if I made the commitment? Was I afraid of being judged? Was that what led me to make the commitment? Was I rushing to make the commitment without making sure it was in alignment with my priorities and my secondary purpose in life, etc.? And I can learn quite a bit about myself and about my habits and patterns with commitments if I'm calm and if I'm asking these questions from a curiosity space. And I can correct disruptive patterns in my life once I understand them better. But if I start in with, I'm just going to tough it out and put my nose to the grindstone and beat myself up or hide the fact that I didn't live up to this commitment and lie about it so other people think I did the commitment but I didn't really live up to it, I just create more blockage to my ability to see the truth, to understand the dynamic in myself, and make a correction. So there's all kinds of factors that might lead me to make commitments that I don't really want to follow through on, or maybe I want to follow through on them, but they aren't really in alignment with my secondary purpose or my values and priorities or my goals in relationship or my goals in another major part of my life. And if I start to analyze those things more clearly before deciding to make a commitment, then I'm going to discover I don't break commitments as often. Now, the 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership talks on a regular basis about how important it is to be in integrity. This number six is this, I commit to the masterful practice of integrity, including acknowledging all authentic feelings, expressing the unarguable truth, and keeping my agreements. Now, when they talk about that in the chapter, they say that what their goal is to help their people, the leaders they coach and individuals, to reach a 90%, 9-0, 9 out of 10 or 90 out of 100 percent follow through on the agreements they make. And then they say, you know, some people might say that's not a high enough. We should be shooting for 100%. And they point out that realistically, things happen. Like, there are changes in life. There are realizations that, wow, I really wasn't clear about this when I made the agreement, etc. And so they offer a process for being clear and mending relationships or mending your connection, your integrity, repairing it when there's been a break in a commitment or in an agreement. And they offer a process for it. However, it is really important to me that they recognize that no one is going to make 100% good on every single agreement they make, because things happen and they change. But they also do say it's very important then to go directly to the person, to be the one to tell them, I need to get something clear between us. I made this agreement and I either didn't keep it, or it's clear to me that I'm not going to keep it. And I don't need to tell them why, but I can tell them that it's not going to happen or it didn't happen. And then I can say, my relationship with you is very important, and I wonder if you can think of a way that I might repair this integrity or this trust between us. So there is no such thing as a small breach of integrity, the way they talk about it. And one of the ways that in my work with people for years now has been to say, let me analyze what was going on with me when I made this agreement, to see if there was part of a lack of clarity in me, or perhaps competing motivations in me that weren't very clear that led me to make the commitment in the first place. And that might be part of what I learn. And sometimes I might even share that with somebody if I made a commitment with them and then I didn't keep it. And that sharing might demonstrate to them my integrity and my willingness to be better about agreements I make in the future. And if they're willing, they could give me trust that it won't happen again. But trust is a gift people give. It's not something that I earn. It's really important for me, for myself and my other relationships, that I act in a way that is trustworthy. And yet, as I act in the way that's trustworthy, every individual I encounter and interact with makes their own decisions about whether or not they're going to choose to trust me or withhold their trust and judge me or distrust me, etc. So I say to people, if someone has done something to you and you've considered it bad or wrong, then please pardon them soon and often. Do your own forgiveness work to remove the negative energies in you that might get resonated when you think that what they did was so wrong. Do that pardoning and forgiveness work soon and often. However, when it comes to trust, if someone has done something that you seriously consider is wrong, it doesn't make any sense in my mind for you to trust them again unless they've done four things. And those four things are as follows. Number one, to begin with, it's very important that they acknowledge, they agree with you in your assessment that what they did was wrong. It was either out of integrity or it was hurtful or it was dishonest or whatever. Because if they don't even agree with you that what they did was wrong, there's no reason for you to believe they won't do it again. And this happens on a regular basis. You know, I know people that they think there's no problem swearing and name calling, and so I blew up in anger. It's no big deal. Let it go. And so I blew you off for lunch. So I just set an appointment for next week, and they don't even acknowledge, I really feel bad about this. It was out of integrity. I'm sorry you took the time, and I didn't make good on it. But there are people that don't admit it's that big a deal. And if they won't even agree with me that what they did was wrong, I don't need to beat them up and I don't need to judge them. But it doesn't really make any sense for me to make another lunch date with somebody who blew me off and doesn't even think it was a bad deal to blow me off. So the second thing in my list of four things is, if they've done something I think is seriously wrong, they would, after admitting that it was wrong or not useful or hurtful, then they make an apology in a way that I feel is sincere. And this is one where many times people will say, sorry, but let's just move past that and let's just schedule another lunch date. To my eye and ear, that is not a sincere apology. And if I go ahead and make another lunch date with someone who apologizes like that when my interpretation of the apology is that it's not sincere, if they blow me off again, that is my responsibility. I'm the one who set me up for that by choosing to trust somebody who hadn't done all four things that were in the middle of listing. First, admit that what they did was wrong. Second, apologize in a way that I feel is sincere. And the third thing is, it doesn't make any sense for me to trust somebody that I think has wronged me unless they have made amends in whatever way possible for whatever they did that was wrong. What would that look like? Well, if they insulted me in public, to make a public apology. If they broke a lamp in my office, they pay to replace the lamp. If they stood me up for a lunch meeting and I drove, you know, the half an hour to get to them, they apologize, they offer to pay my gas, they offer for the next lunch meeting to, you know, buy me lunch and drive to me so I'm not driving out of my way. Those kinds of things would be making amends, compensating for the loss, etc. And the last piece is, it doesn't make any sense for me to trust that somebody won't do something again that I found seriously wrong unless they make concrete changes in their life to try and ensure that it doesn't happen again. What might that look like? Well, if somebody flies into a rage in my office and grabs my lamp and throws it across the room and breaks it, then concrete changes would include getting some counseling for anger control or going on a medication for impulse control, along with everything else we've listed, agreeing that what they did was bad or wrong, completely out of bounds, making amends, apologizing in a way that I feel is sincere, and then making concrete changes in their life to try and ensure that it doesn't happen again. Now, if I have somebody in my life and they did something that I consider seriously wrong, and they do all four of those things, it's still my choice whether to trust them again or not. As we said in the beginning, trust is a gift we give people, just like the forgiveness is a gift I give myself and the pardoning is a gift I give somebody else. People don't have to earn my pardoning or my trust for me to give it to them. I have worked with countless people over the last 47 years who've chosen to trust people who have never once acted in a trustworthy fashion. But they give them another chance, and they give them another chance, and they give them another chance. And that's okay, because that's a gift they're giving. Their trust is a gift they give. And they're the ones who cope with the consequences of choosing to trust people who do not act in a trustworthy fashion. I've also known people who have done something that their friends or family members thought was seriously wrong, and they've agreed it was wrong, apologized in a way that everybody felt was sincere, made actual amends financially, emotionally, logistically, etc., and made concrete changes in their life to try and ensure it doesn't happen again. And the person who felt offended never trusts them again, despite the person going through all of that work to act in a more trustworthy way. So if that happens, people say, well, then why would I do all of that? Agree it was wrong, apologize. Why would I do that if the person isn't going to trust me at the end of it? And my answer to that is because it makes you a better person, because it will improve your relationships across the board when you correct your own integrity. So number six for the 15 bottom line, or the 15 commitments of conscious leadership, number six says, I commit to a masterful practice of integrity. Why am I doing that? Well, in their system of work, I'm doing that to increase my own energy flow. Because when I am in integrity, the energy flows. When I break a commitment and I go to the person and I let them know I broke the commitment and I offer to do something to repair their trust in me or the integrity, that keeps my energy flowing. That leaves me more productive. When I break integrity and I don't actively work to communicate about that with people or try to avoid it or blame it on somebody else, it blocks my energy. So, we've got about 10 or 11 minutes left. Our call-in number is 563-999-3581. Press 1, call that number, press 1, and let us know what you think about the monologue so far today. Is this relevant in your life? Are you a person who's ever had a difficulty keeping your commitments? Are you a person that's ever gotten angry at yourself when you've missed a commitment? Is any of what we're saying resonating for anybody on the call? 563-999-3581. I remember one time in particular, there had been an agreement to do 5 worksheets a day for 40 days, and there was a whole bunch of people in the community on the radio show, and they were pairing up, and they were agreeing to text each other. And so I said, okay, I'll agree to do that. And my agreement was that I will try to do 5 worksheets a day for 40 days. That's my target. But I knew full well I probably wasn't going to do 5 worksheets a day every day because of what was going on in my family, what was going on in my work life, you know, the various side projects I did, the fact that it was going to be happening through the holiday season, and I was involved with 4 or 5 different families at that time. So I remember one night that it was an all-day affair from early morning to late night, traveling one family to another, working things out, helping people get their holiday work done, etc. And it got to be about 10 o'clock at night, and I was heading to bed, and I hadn't done the worksheets. And the person that was my partner had been texting, and I let him know, no, I hadn't done them, and I wasn't going to get them done tonight. And he sent a barrage of angry texts about my breaking my commitment, my letting myself down, and as though if I didn't live up to the 5 worksheets that day, it was going to be a devastating blow somehow to him or to myself. And I just quit answering the texts. But it was one of the things that led me to then talk more in detail about, okay, number one, perhaps I wasn't clear. When I agreed to this accountability partner, I didn't say, I will do 5 worksheets a day come hell or high water, and I give you permission to berate me and challenge me and send one of my $100 checks to a charity I hate. I didn't make that kind of commitment. So maybe I wasn't clear enough. Next, the anger at yourself or someone else for what you perceive is a break in commitment or integrity is not related to their break in integrity. It's a self-induced nonsense. It is an alarm system within me when I generate anger, either at myself or what my mind tells me is at someone else. And if I recognize that that anger is counterproductive, it's a negative emotion, and I do the processes that we talk about here, it can lead to a tremendous series of revelations. It can lead to a better functioning in my life and more clarity about my issues, the traumas I brought with me into this moment, etc. And that's far more productive and useful in my mind than either pushing myself, forcing myself to try and make a commitment or a deadline when I don't have any investment in doing it anymore, or beating myself up mentally and emotionally. God forbid some people actually do physical beating themselves up, or they eat unhealthy things, or they drink things to numb out from the pain that they generate when they have not lived up to a commitment. And so I'm strongly encouraging people to live in that curiosity questioning state and explore a whole range of different factors that may be leading to me making commitments that I don't really have any intention to keep, or making commitments that are not in alignment with my values and priorities and my secondary purpose, and or being so rigid once I've made a commitment that I'm unwilling to acknowledge that situations have changed and it's no longer in my best interest to follow through on that commitment. And what they offer in the 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership is the recognition that that does happen. And when it happens, do the clearing process that they recommend in Chapter 6, which involves direct communication, going directly to the person you had the commitment with, and letting them know right up front that it didn't happen or it's not going to happen, and that you acknowledge that this is a breach in integrity and you are willing to do something to try to repair that breach or mend that relationship. But however you do it, I strongly encourage the dismantling of the negative emotions first, and the stepping into the wonder questions and the curiosity that allow us to understand, okay, what's a deeper understanding, a level of understanding about what's going on here? What is it that motivates me from time to time or consistently to make commitments that I either don't plan to follow through on or I'm not capable of following through on? So we've got about 5 minutes left, 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. Or you can just wait for the next hour. Michael and Jeannie will be here live today, and they can take your comments or questions, whether it's about anything we've talked about today, Winfred Doerr and the zingperformance.com website, or any other topic we've bounced around on today. I'll remind us all that we have a MindShifter support group tonight, 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central Time. Information on joining us is available at mindshiftersacademy.org website. And we have time for a call, 563-999-3581. What's on your mind? Or what would you like us to talk about tomorrow? Because there's another day this week where we've got another couple of hours to entertain your comments, questions, answers, soliloquies. I should also remind people that they can still go to the integrativementalhealthsummit.org website and get access to the recordings. It costs some money to get access to recordings. It's not a lot of money for most people, but it's trying to help them recover the cost of putting on that wonderful summit and bringing over 40 professionals together to talk about integrative solutions to mental health challenges. And for $125 or $150, you can get access to all of the recordings from that three-day summit. And if that's not of interest to you, you might pass the information along to somebody else that might be interested. It's integrativementalhealthsummit.org. I read an article in The Atlantic yesterday that had me wanting more, so I pre-ordered the book that the article is referring to. And this has little, if anything, to do with our work here on Mindshifters Radio. It's just interesting. The title of the article is Human History Gets a Rewrite. A brilliant new account upends bedrock assumptions about 30,000 years of change. And this article is about a book that's coming out and I pre-ordered it, that talks about Graeber, G-R-A-E-B-E-R, and the genius that he is, that he was, he died recently, and the most recent book that he published, is published posthumously, he died last year. The title of the book, I believe, is The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. And the author of the article talks about how he had lunch with a person, he cold called a colleague in the anthropology department for assistance. He didn't know anything about the person. He just selected him because he was young, and therefore he figured he would be more likely to agree to talk. And he says 5 minutes into the lunch, he realized that he was in the presence of a genius. He clarifies here, not just an extremely intelligent person, but an absolute genius. He said there's a qualitative difference there. The individual across the table from him seemed to belong to a different order of being, like a visitor from a higher dimension. He says, I had never experienced anything like it before. He said, I quickly went from trying to keep up with him to hanging on for dear life to just letting go and simply sitting there in complete wonder. In the 20 years since that lunch, David Graeber published two books and was let go by Yale, despite a stellar record, probably because of radical politics. Then he published two more books and got a job at Goldsmiths University in London. Then he published four more books, including Debt, The First 5,000 Years, as a book title. And then he got a job at the London School of Economics and published two more books and co-wrote a third. Then he established himself not only among the foremost social thinkers of our time, as someone who is blazingly original, stunningly wide-ranging, and impossibly well-read, but also as an organizer and an intellectual leader of the activist left on both sides of the Atlantic. He was credited, among other things, with helping launch the Occupy movement, and he coined its term, slogan, we are the 99%. So that kind of a guy, that kind of an intellect, has dug deep into the research and created a book that's rewriting what people have believed is the history of human civilization. And it's a fascinating article to read in The Atlantic. And the title of that article is Dawn of Everything. I guess that's the title of the book, Dawn of Everything, History of Humanity. Well, that's our show for today. Michael and Jeannie should be coming up here. I'll remind us all that we come from love.
Here.
We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it. And thanks for playing recordings for us the last 2 days and tomorrow. I appreciate it.
You're entirely welcome and deserving. Have a great show.
Thank you. Thank you. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Thursday, October the 21st, 2021. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you in the queue to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. Welcome, Michael.
Well, thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. Once again, we're honored and delighted that you're here to engage in this conversation about this awesome understanding of physics and physiology and psychology and genetics that comes out of the first century Aramaic language. And of course, our focus is that of healing. And we need to distinguish healing from treatment. Treatment is something you do to something that doesn't exist. And kind of a difficult paradigm to get your head around, but you know, people talk about healing. Well, I need to heal my body. Well, my offering is you can't heal what isn't there. You can't heal a body because no such thing as a body exists. And people shake their heads. Oh, Michael, you just don't understand. It's like, are you sure it's me that doesn't understand? Let's listen to two of the greatest scientific minds that have ever existed on planet Earth. Let's listen to Albert Einstein. Albert is bringing forward an understanding that few in the so-called scientific worlds even still have a clue about. But here's what he says. On such things as matter, we have been all wrong. What we have heretofore called matter is energy. Energy whose vibration has been so lowered as to be perceptible to the senses, there is no matter. If there is no matter, there is no body. If there is no body, obviously there's no diseased body. Bodies can't be healed because what doesn't exist can't be healed. Let's listen to Max Planck. This goes back over 100 years ago. Max is receiving the Nobel Prize in Physics. Actually, back a few years ago, we were invited to a conference by the National Institute of Science in Denmark. I actually got to sleep in the office with all of the possessions, the notebooks and such of Max Planck. And as he's receiving the Nobel Prize in Physics, here's what he says. And, you know, the ancient scriptures talk about there'll come a time when the whole world will be fooled. Oh, we've been so deeply fooled. But listen to Max. He says this. As a man who spent his entire life studying matter, I can tell you this much. There is no matter as such. Our entire world, he says, is made of succeedingly smaller patterns of vibratory fields nested one within another within another. Now, if you think bodies are real and bodies can be diseased, then you got to throw Einstein and Max Planck out. Go check out the work of the Max Planck Institute based in Max's thinking. You know, it doesn't get much better than that in the science realm. We hear a lot of science denial today. Why? because people have been fooled. Let's use an analogy. Let's imagine we get someone who looks in a mirror, and we look at that face in the mirror, and we see a deep scar on that face. And somebody says, I'm going to go into that mirror and I'm going to fix that scar. Well, can you fix the scar in the mirror? Well, there's no scar. There's the appearance of a scar. You remember this man Yeshua 2,000 years ago said, don't judge by appearances. Don't get lost in appearances. The mirror is a reflection. You can't fix a reflection. You've got to go to the cause of the reflection to even think that it could be healed is such foolishness that mind is obviously lost and will never find answers. If you've been fooled, your mind is so hopelessly lost, you will never find answers. You've got to get down to the truth. Now, you know, the picture in the mirror, you could put a bandage over the scar. That's basically what medicine, what treatment does. Well, let's put a bandage on this. See, we covered up the scar. Now the scar is gone. No, the scar isn't gone. The scar has been hidden. But the scar remains right where it was. As long as we're dealing with reflections and not causes, we don't see results. And as long as our mind is working on trying to correct the reflection, looking and focusing on the part of the body that's broken, then we're working in, we're spending all of our resources in something that isn't even there. And it certainly is not correctly perceived. So if we look at, well, let's first go back. Let's go to the opening words in the book of John. If only this had been translated properly in English, there'd be such a resolution of problems that it wouldn't be funny. But we're told, it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh, and they equate the Word with this man, Yeshua. And it just is not justifiable from the Aramaic perspective. It's a foolish point. Because what it says there is, in the beginning was the mind energy, and the mind energy became flesh. In order for the reflection, the so-called body, or the image in the mirror, to heal, the cause, the place where the problem is, must be healed. Since the so-called body is a reflection of the mind, wounds held in the mind are reflected as anomalies in the so-called body. So bodies cannot be healed because bodies aren't diseased, because bodies don't exist. Now, I'm not saying there's nothing there, but there's an energy field that is that cause behind what we call the world of matter and the world of bodies. And that's the place where the primary energy is organized. Listen to that word. Break that word down. Organized, turned into organic structure. And people are looking at the mirror, and they're chopping away at the mirror, and they're drugging the mirror, and they're herbing the mirror, and they're doing all sorts of things to the mirror. But they've lost contact with the cause that the mirror is a reflection of. So people work on symptoms in the body, and the symptoms are nothing more than a mirror image or a reflection of the mind that holds some sort of disintegrative energy that never belonged within this structure. So if your whole focus is on fixing that broken body part, your focus is on trying to fix the scar on the face in the mirror. Place where the work needs to be done is in this massive multi-generational database called the mind, reflected as the body. And when we start to own, and remember, we've got relative to this integrated energy system called the body-mind unit, there are basically two qualities of energy. There's that which build the system up and that which tear the system down. They're integrative energies that bring it into deeper states of integration and what we would call health. And there's disintegrative, those things which would take us out of the integrated state. In Aramaic, the word that was used to describe energetic patterns that would take us out of the integrated state or create what we call diseases, create the reflection of a broken body part, the word to describe that was the word sin. Now, when you realize the true nature of the word sin, it's got nothing to do with the Greek idea of you're a guilty person, you should have, you didn't. The word sin is an archery term. When you fired at the target on the shooting range and you missed the bullseye, the scorekeeper yelled sin. That's all it means. It's an energy that's off the mark. And you remember they told us the wages of sin is death. The result is the reflection called a body, when it can no longer sustain life because it is so full of energies that are off the mark, the energy system that sustains or becomes organized as a body dissipates, disappears, falls apart. And so the so-called body, the reflection in the mirror, disappears. And we call that death. So the wages of sin is death. So the pursuit is not the pursuit of fixing or healing a body, but looking at where the mind is engaging in mind energy that is out of harmony with love. And if it's out of harmony with love, wherever it is in your tissue structure is set to feed you back information. And when you look at it, or at least you think you're looking at it, you look at an anomaly in it, you say, oh, there's a diseased part there. No, the energy that stands back of and behind, the energy that is superior to the appearance, is in a disintegrative state. So the appearance it reflects as reflects disintegration. But the reflection isn't where the disintegration is. And so we must come back to cause. The mind must be healed. What are the wounds held in the mind? Oh, when I was 3 years old, I was dissed by my older brother. Oh, when I was in the birth process, my mother decided she didn't want to have a baby, rejected me. Oh, when. And all of these energetic patterns that are not based in love and that are cumulative generation to generation to generation to generation reflect as energetic patterns held within one's energy field. Most people, the most tragic thing they could think of doing is having to face that horrific, painful experience that happened to them at some time in their lives, to really come full-blown face-to-face and experience the energy as it is. But that's the only way healing ever occurs, is when we can bring forward that original disorganized state of energy and bring it forward in the presence of love, where a transmutation occurs and the broken part changed. It's gone. It's restructured in an instant. So the tool that's so important, the tool that's missing from the world, and yet it's the tool that most people don't want to really, truly touch, because it means you have to look at that. You have to deal with that. No, I just want a pill. No, I just want a surgeon to fix it. No, I just. Don't make me look there. Don't make me feel. I just want another shot of scotch. And life, opportunities for us to learn forgiveness, marches on, bringing us to experience after experience after experience after experience of why is this happening to me again? And we try to fix the outer expression, the image in the mirror, and not feel and not deal with the original energy that's still being carried around in the field, that is the disorganized state of mind energy that reflects as a disorganized state of quote-unquote body or mind or emotion. Can we embrace those energetic patterns and hold to the presence of active love? If we can't, then this man Yeshua 2,000 years ago delivered a tool. The tool was called forgiveness. And forgiveness has nothing to do with me letting you off the hook for the disorganized state of energy that's going on in me and is at the root of and is the cause of my pain. Now, you may be the one who came along, resonated it into activity for me. I had it neatly packed away and hidden. And here I am, the 87th different time, and you're the 42nd person that's brought it up for me, and the world will counsel me to let you off the hook because you brought that up for me, and I've missed another opportunity to embrace the original energy of offense, disintegration, that is held somewhere in my tissue structure, that I say is where my pain is. And when I hold my breath, that's the place where I have the opportunity to embrace that energy in the presence of active love and remove it. That's what the forgiveness tool is designed for. But it means you have to look, you have to feel, you have to deal with what's in there. And the last thing that most people want to do is to look, feel, or deal with what's inside of themselves. And we're here to support you having the courage and the tools so that it's not just getting lost in a traumatic energy that you've dissociated from, but it is finding that traumatic energy at its very root, being in the practice of having love conscious and active. And if I can't do it for myself, then I have someone who's there to support me who can. And stepping into process. And again, in this work, we define processing as the ability to hold love conscious, active, and present when something less than love comes up. So if I have any form of physical, mental, emotional disease, there's an energy in me that I need to allow to come forward to full awareness. In the presence of active love, mine or someone who can hold that space for me, when that love is present, there is a dissolution of sin. There's the resolution of the disintegrative energy. And in the instant where that happens, the appearance of disease is gone. Now let's take an extreme example. There's one recorded event where in Lourdes in France, where these miracle waters and people hold this belief that by visiting Lourdes, they'll be healed. And in one case, there's a medically documented case of a man who his hip is literally eaten away with cancer. It's virtually gone. He doesn't have a hip. But he knows if he can enter those healing waters, he will be restored. Now, they've got x-rays of there's no hip there. He goes into the waters. He comes back out and he walks away. And they have x-rays of a fully, perfectly formed hip. How can that be? If you understand how energy systems work, how energy fields work, how so-called matter is a reflection, then it's pretty simple. It makes perfect sense. I don't know for that man what he had to process. I don't know if you talked to him if he knew what he needed to process. Cognitive awareness is not necessary, although it is often a part of the process. But one must process whatever the root energy is. And, you know, in a case like that, it might have been something 20 generations old. And he may have no cognitive awareness whatsoever what he processed when he went in there. Whatever it is that's going on in your body, stop trying to fix your body and fix your mind. You can spend all the money and time and energy and professionals and healers and in the world. But if you don't deal with the mind energy behind it, healing is never going to be reflected in the mirror. So in essence, that's the bottom line of what we're here to understand and what we're here to bring into full expression. And I'm going to go to page 133 in the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? We have missed you guys for a couple of days. I assume Jeannie, I didn't listen to the first minute or two of the show, but I assume Jeannie told you that we are having a grandparents' vacation with our granddaughter, who's been circling here for 3 years, and we have the other set of grandparents with us that are up in the Shenandoah Valley, and just we have these beautiful, 70-degree sunny days. Just been wonderful to be out and playing, tubing, and just all kinds of fun stuff. And so we took a couple of days to be focused with these other grandparents and then set the time of day aside today so that we could do the show and touch in with everyone. And the paragraph in the book, we're talking to Richard about this idea of conscious active present love. And Richard is wondering, is it possible for these family disease patterns to be changed? And my answer to him is absolutely. My experience is that holding the space of conscious, active, present love, and I use that term. That's a term that's been with me for decades. And I use that conscious, active, present love to reflect that We're not talking about the world's idea of, oh, I love you, you know, sappy, syrupy, sweetly, you know. We're not talking about that. That's not love. That's got nothing to do with love. That's a false concept. Talking about tapping the being, the created essence that is love in you, like the fact of your being is the active presence of love. We're talking about tapping that on the shoulder and awakening it from the sleep of a world of hostility or fear so that it becomes fully conscious, fully present, and fully active in the space. It is the activity of that present love that creates the healing process. And for most people, it's going to take some practice. I mean, literally cultivating your relationship with yourself as active present love. And then being willing to be freed of the self that you thought you were that's based in hostility or fear so that the true being that you are can replace that false image in your mind. That's all a part of the healing process. So we're talking about conscious, active, present love of is the actual presence, awake and aware of a being, not some kind of syrupy, soupy, I love you state. And if you haven't practiced that, there's some serious work to be done to disidentify with the hostility, the fear, the pains, the diseases, and the suffering of the world. And if that's what you're identified with, by being identified with it, that's what you empower. And if that's what you've empowered, then that's what reflects in your process, in your life, in your form, your expression. So we're inviting people to learn to withdraw, and it's forgiveness that allows the withdrawal. It's forgiveness that collapses the false states of mind that are fake. I love you. It's getting rid of that fake stuff and actually being the presence of love. So I'm offering to Richard that yes, that's exactly what it takes to resolve everything that surfaces within us. Richard was reaching new levels of clarity and enthusiasm in his process. Anyone who's done this work knows that the event that follows a new level of empowerment is often a healing crisis. It is at this point in the process that many people become just absolutely filled with self-doubt about their ability to truly heal their pain. For some, the process seems too hard. For some, too complicated. For others, too simple. And for still others, the pain seems too deep. He looked forlorn as old feelings of hopelessness surfaced for healing. This sounds so hopeless, Michael. If all of my pain is inside of me, how can I ever get away from it? Why are we not all taught this as children? That we create our own reality. How will I ever work through this? How will I ever work this out in my relationship? How can I slow down, Richard? Remember, hold on. These feelings will pass. The surfacing of hopelessness is an opportunity to deal with that reality that's resonant in your mind. And, you know, hopelessness, you know, the mind functions through every cell in the body. So that hopelessness, that energy of hopelessness that Richard's now touching into, and it's one that most everybody holds, could be stored anywhere within the structure or be reflecting anywhere within the structure. If it's in the knees, it's going to reflect as knee pain. If it's in the head, it's going to reflect as a headache. If it's in the shoulder, it's going to feel like shoulder pain. And people, oh, I need to heal my knee pain. I need to heal my headache. I need to heal my shoulder pain. No, you don't. You need to deal with what your mind is doing. That reflects at those different qualities of dis-ease. The surfacing of hopelessness is an opportunity to deal with that reality in your mind. You're at least learning these things now. Most people go through their entire lives without ever discovering what's going on, without ever having tools. And the key thought at this point in the conversation with Richard is upset is an opportunity to learn forgiveness and let go of blame. And so I'm going to complete the reading at that point. And Miss Jeannie, let's open the phone lines and see if there's anybody out there with a thought for us. Any questions from the last 2 days' shows? And basically that's the workshop, Getting the Stress You Need, that Jeannie had set up to play. And, you can travel the globe and you can talk to all the experts on stress. And they're going to tell you, different ways, different things. You know, they say, well, just breathe and, you know, do this or do that or do that. But in the last 2 days, you've heard exactly how stress is created and exactly how stress is resolved. Now, I can understand if people are unwilling to remove that which is the driver for their stress, that the stress doesn't go away and they go, well, this doesn't work. But if you take the tool of forgiveness, and if you're not using it at this point, I support you. And it is the deepest resistance in this work is to doing forgiveness, to engaging in forgiveness. Because you gotta look at yourself bare, square up, straight in the face. If you're not using the forgiveness tool at this point, I invite you to go to our website, whyagain.org. In the upper left-hand corner, the first two words of the page say start here. Click that link, and it will walk you through everything you need to know about forgiveness. And I mean everything. I mean 40 years of work. It's there. It's free. Go take it. Use it. Put it to work. And or you can download the worksheet from the website. I mean, you can actually do the step-by-step forgiveness process on the website. There's lots of guidance there for it. You can download the worksheets, print them on your own printer, and have them there to fill out. And or you can go to your app store on your phone and type in the words Heartland, H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D, as one word, Heartland, Aramaic, A-R-A-M-A-I-C, forgiveness. When you type that into your app store, you'll be looking at the world's only forgiveness app. Thank you to Miss Jeannie for I don't even know how many hundreds, perhaps thousands of hours. Well, in total, behind that app, there are thousands and thousands of hours of work. I mean, literally, thousands of hours of work. Not just the mechanical part that Jeannie did in putting it together and assembling it and directing that process, but then the research on forgiveness. The app's totally private. You can put anything in it you want. You're the only one who will ever see it or ever have access to it. When you finish a worksheet, if you check out of the app, it just goes back to the digital world. It's gone. Or you can print it as a PDF in your own phone or computer, wherever you're using it. And if you do that, the app will ask for one more permission. There's only one permission asked for by the app, and that's to use the internet. We purposely designed it so that you can feel secure putting anything in there that you want and knowing you're the only one that will ever see it. And yes, if you decide that you're going to save the worksheet and print it, then it has to have a place to store it, and it's going to ask for permission to put it in your storage device. Other than that, it's totally private. We invite you to put it to work. And then we're here to answer questions and to encourage and support and make these tools viable and available to literally every mind, heart, and being on the planet. So if you're out there in listener land and you've been using the tools, or if you haven't and you have a question, this is the space for dialogue, for us to have an interactive conversation. If I were in your hometown presenting what I've presented in this last half hour on a platform locally, I'm in your local, you know, university or prison or library or high school or community center or church, and I've said what I've said in the first half hour, and I completed my presentation, and I walked down off the stage, and you were there in the audience, so here you are, along with a couple hundred other people. You're walking over to me to say, Michael, what about? So this is the time for your what about question. If you were in that audience and you had the opportunity to walk over to me, what would you be saying to Michael Rice? And push one and say it. We're here for that interaction. We're here to create that support. And, you know, if you feel like your voice might be a little shaky, oh, gee, I'm going to be on the radio. I don't know if I, well, you know, can you make it okay for your voice to be shaky? It's like, so what? Who cares? Nobody cares about that. Well, I don't want people to know who I am. Well, give us a fake name. I don't care. That's up to you. Well, my questions aren't that important. Well, you know, oftentimes it's the beginners that ask a question that take me and take others back to the core principles and allow a more complete understanding of the process. So please ask your question if you've got one, or put in your request for support. If you're on one of those stations where we can't see you, our call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you dial that number, you'll be listening to the show live on your phone. And if you push one, we'll be having a conversation. So if you're out there in this one, and push one, let's have a conversation. Ms. Jeannie, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up? Great.
No, we do not have anybody with a hand up, but I had something. I'm not sure if you were referring to a different time when you said we stayed at a place where Max Planck's stuff was. But if you're talking about when we were in Denmark, that was actually Niels Bohr.
Oh, you're right. Niels, oh my goodness, I get them mixed up. You're right. It was Niels Bohr's office that I get
He's
to
the
sleep
one that
in.
Did the Manhattan Project and all that.
Right. It was another time. You're right.
It was a 2013 conference on the creativity and science in society.
And it was his 100th birthday celebration by the Nobel Prize awarding group there. That we were invited to their conference. It was pretty cool. It was pretty amazing. Sitting around in a room with all these Nobel Prize winners and Nobel laureates and having conversations. Jeannie was sitting with the head of the group, and she decided she needed to defer to me at one point. No, you need to ask Michael those questions. Share that story with us, sweetie, if you would.
Well, it's just that everybody there was some top physicist or researcher or scientist or whatever. They're all this intellectual, you know, and it was like I would be telling him about the work, and then he would flip over into, it was almost like they would almost get it, and then they'd flip back over into the intellectual stuff, and then he'd start asking questions, you know, that was like way over my head as far as, you know, scientific or physics or whatever. And Michael was about three people down the table, and I'm like, you really need to talk to him. They were brilliant minds there. It was amazing. But, they would, like, it would almost be like, you know, they were listening, and he'd almost get what I was saying, and then it was like a deflection. Instead of just absorbing what I was saying, he had to go into the intellectual part of it and the explanation of it instead of just accepting.
Well, and my take would be that he was talking to you as a human being and listening to and hearing you and getting into the process work that you were offering him. And then his head kicked in and said, wait a minute, I don't do this sort of thing. I have to figure it out. And, of course, that's the number one pseudo-solution of the non-being mind, figuring it out, and that's what keeps us out of the real process work that's necessary to do.
Exactly.
Anyway, that was we've definitely gotten to play with some pretty interesting folks around the country and around the world in this work, in this process. And so if you're out there in listener land, we're here to answer your questions. What can we do to support you? How can we assist you in your search for healing your mind? Or
if you're
perhaps
new to,
your search is
if you're new
free. Go ahead, sweetie.
I was just going to say, if you were new to this work, press 1. Oh, we had a hand just go up. So let's introduce our caller, 636. You're on the air. Who do we have?
Hi, this is Shirley. I'm kind of new to this process. So I was listening last night, and I was super thankful that you kind of went through how to go about doing it a little bit more structured, which I appreciated that. And then, you know, so I was listening during my lunch hour. I had talked to Jeannie before. And then you started in with going back to, like, when you're a child and with your mother. And, of course, totally forgot. I don't even know. I don't know anything about that relationship, really. She died when I was in my 40s, but I tried to not, I don't know, I don't think I had expectations of her. But as a mom myself, I know I had expectations of myself. And so, and of course, you know, what happens? I was raised by, you know, well, my mom, but 4 older sisters. And so when you're doing this, and I'm kind of excited, it's like, oh, finally I can maybe do something. I'm thinking one of my sisters calls and interrupts. So I need to go back and listen to the whole radio show again, but has that ever happened where somebody, it takes a lot of work to think about the past, about a relationship like that?
It definitely requires us to do something much different than our culture has taught us to do. Our culture has taught us to skim across the surface and don't look within. And, you know, I mean, we're out there searching in the stars and, you know, flying to the moon. And most people haven't even looked inside their own hearts and dealt with and processed the depths of emotional trauma, family trauma, cultural trauma, global trauma that is moving in them. And they live to try to keep separated from it. You take a look at all, you know, if somebody isn't using, let's say, for instance, let's take an example of alcohol to anesthetize trauma, they would never take the second drink of alcohol. Kind of like, you know, it's pretty dramatic when people say, well, you know, I've never smoked before. Oh, you know, and teenagers, here, why don't you try one? Oh, yeah, I can do that. And the body gave a pretty clear signal, this is not appropriate. But because at the same time as that toxic energy is taken in, that nicotine creates such an anesthetic effect that the person who's coughing and sputtering, you know, half to death, goes, oh, I'm not feeling pain right now. My pain is gone. This is good. And they'll work their way through until their body stops the rejection process and lets them do it. It's the same with alcohol. And I've seen that it's not as dramatic with alcohol as with, say, for instance, smoking, the body's rejection of it. But I worked with a woman back probably 30-plus years ago who, you know, basically her husband was a businessman and, you know, she was a housewife and took care of the kids, and every night he'd come home late for dinner. You know, they were millionaire types and compulsive workaholic, compulsive alcoholic, although she proclaimed we were not alcoholics. But every night when he'd get home, you know, 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night, they'd have three or four drinks before dinner and a bottle of wine with dinner and three or four drinks after dinner, go to bed, slosh. But they weren't alcoholics. This is something went on for years until she became involved in this work. And then when she started doing this work, she realized that she was using alcohol as a medication to anesthetize herself. And so she stopped using alcohol for a period of about 5 years. And in a session, you know, 5 or so years later, she shared with me that she'd been at a party, hadn't touched alcohol in years, and somebody offered her a drink of hard liquor. And she's like, yeah, I'll have a drink. And what she said was that she just took a sip of that, whatever it was, I don't know, vodka or whiskey, whatever. She said, I just took a sip of it, and it felt like razor blades in my kidneys. Now, most people don't feel the razor blades in their kidneys. I mean, that's a part of the body, that and the liver. I mean, they're totally trashed after a number of years of using alcohol. And people call it fun to drink. But it's not fun. It's, oh, I get a few minutes without pain. And that's translated into, oh, this is good. Until we get rid of the pain. And then you wouldn't think about your second drink, because the first one would be, if you experience the trauma it's causing the body, you never touch the stuff again. And so to be willing to start to face what's in there and to make that journey within, to climb down inside yourself, if you come from a cultural history that's outer focused, you know, accomplishment, family, which is wonderful, all of those things, but never spending time going within and dealing with the inner space. And that's what we're inviting people to do. And, you know, as you talk about it, it sounds like you're the early adopter in your family. You're the first one, you know, who said, I'm going to start to go in and look at these things within me. And that means that you have to do the heavy lifting and start to work through some of those things and open a different possibility within your family system by doing so within yourself. And it sounds like if you have no recall, you know, were you in your mom's life up until that age when you were 40 and she passed?
Well, yeah. So as a child, she was hospitalized often till the time I went to kindergarten. And I was born very late in their life. You know, my mom was like 39. I mean, back then, years ago, she was 39 and my dad was 42. And, you know, she announced that she was pregnant with me at my oldest sister's high school graduation. So feeling that it wasn't an excited happiness kind of thing, it was more like you've got to be kidding kind of thing. And,
right.
You know, I know she went in and she had to have a gallbladder removed and she had to have a hysterectomy. And then, I don't know, they used to pull teeth a lot instead of repairing them for some odd reason. So she had to have that done. So she was gone a lot from me, both mentally and physically. And my sister, you know, were held to take care of normal things, like she needs to eat, like I need to eat or whatever. But my dad, he was laid off a lot. He was a tool and die maker, and the trade kind of, you know, got kind of shaky from the 60s to through the 70s. And so as a young child, he tried to take over and do the nurturing. So my relationship was strong with him, which caused more problems between my mom and my dad.
Yeah.
I don't see her as a nurturer, but that's about all, you know, and I've tried to, I don't want to judge her. You know, I'm sure she probably did her best. You know, but
right.
But I guess those shoulds are what I need to start peeling away.
that would probably be useful. You know, there's where you would take the worksheet process and start to process through those dynamics within yourself, because, you know, the mind never forgets anything. Every experience we've gone through, we may have no recall of it, but the mind hasn't forgotten it. It's there. The energetic pattern of it is there, having its influence. And so the idea here is to uncover, with the forgiveness process, you uncover those energetic patterns and you enter into the practice of continuing to breathe when those things move instead of holding the breath, and being able to really look them right square in the face. And rather than losing yourself in identification with those painful moments in your life or that painful self, you really are identifying and recognizing and experiencing from a space of your created essence, love, your being, those experiences. And when you do, what happens is the pained, traumatic events and energetic experiences that are woven into our perception so transparently that we don't even know what it is that we're looking at, start to unravel. And when they unravel, you get to confront some of those really deeply painful moments. But when you keep your breath moving and your tissue structure open and softened, and, you know, again, simply breathe through those experiences and hold to present love, then those energetic patterns become unraveled and no longer are at the root of the constructs of your mind that guide your behavior. Your true being ends up becoming the root of those experiences, and it just changes everything. I mean, it just changes everything.
Okay. So since I have just started at the beginning, I do work usually during the day full time.
Right.
Because I can't spend every day in, day out, you know, sunrise to sunset working on this, what does that time look like that would be reasonable and yet consistent? You recommend, you know, every day for like an hour or three times a week? I mean, what do you think?
Well, if you go back into the ancient teachings, one of the things they suggested that people do is they tithe. And, you know, the churches have made that all about money because their thing is about money so often. But tithing, I think the more important aspect of tithing is giving of your time to your own spiritual process. And if tithing is 10%, that would mean that you would work toward, and, you know, that's something that's going to take time. When I first started doing this work, I was in the business world. I had 3 businesses. I had 60 employees. I ran 18 hours a day, 9 days a week. I didn't have time to do any of this. And there came a point after about 6 years of doing this work part-time that I literally woke up one morning and walked away from this business world, went back to school, went into teaching this full-time. So now I spend all of my time focused in this process. So, but a happy medium is to work toward the point where you put 2.4 hours of your day. You know, I use the acronym TIME, time, intelligence, money, and energy. That you put 10% of that toward your spiritual process and work. That doesn't mean tomorrow you have to spend 2.4 hours on it, but to just over a period of time, reorganize your life so that what's important to you, you spend time paying attention to and doing. Now, the world will keep you running in other directions and busy. I mean, busyness is the number one drug of the world. Jeannie and I did a workshop up in a super high security prison in Ionia, Michigan back a few years ago.
Oh.
And this was a prison where everybody in the prison was a minimum of 25 years, and many of them were lifers.
Wow.
And we did a couple of weeks of workshops, and then one of our teachers up there started to work with the group, went in and did a support group. And the course, the ultimate course that we developed for the prisons is called Laws of Living. We have a a version of that that we teach in the, you know, in the secular world as well. But we designed Laws of Living for the prison, and they were going to, the teacher up there in Ionia was going to do the Laws of Living course within the prison. And the tradition with Laws of Living has always been that the prisoner who's engaged, it's oftentimes, you know, in some programs we've done, it's actually the judge sentencing them to Laws of Living, and they have to pay for it. Well, you know, these guys are 25 years to life. They're not going to pay for a course. So what we did so that and the purpose of that was so they were invested in it. They had something on the table. And so what we did is we set it up so that the requirement was in the 8 weeks that preceded the course, they had to do 5 worksheets a day, the forgiveness worksheet process. They do 5 of those a day, every day, until the course began. And came time for the course to actually begin, every person who had signed up for the course and wanted to do it had the same excuse for the fact that they couldn't turn in 5 worksheets a day. Now, these are guys who are locked up in their cells 23 out of 24 hours per day. If they maybe work in the commissary for a couple hours or in the laundry or something, they might get a couple more hours out of their cells. But 23 out of 24 hours. Guess what every man's reason was for the fact that he couldn't turn in 5 worksheets a day? It was that they were too busy. They're locked in jail cells for 23 out of 24 hours, but they were too busy. Every one of them, that's what they said. They were too busy to do it. And that is like one of the number one drugs of the culture. So I don't say to somebody, well, tomorrow you should start doing 2.4 hours a day, but start to organize your life and recognize the direction you want your life to go and then invest in moving your life in that direction till you get to the point where you've reorganized your life in a way that you put 2.4 hours a day into your spiritual work, this work. And over the period of a lifetime, you will achieve the goal of being redeemed from the family patterns, from the cultural patterns, from the pain, the trauma, the insanity of your culture. And I'm talking about your own individual family culture. We've all got our own insane family cultures and the general culture, that you'll bring a shift and a change to that whole thing, and it's a monumental gift to give to your bloodline. I love what Jonas Salk, the inventor of the Salk vaccine, says. I think this was far more important than his invention of the Salk vaccine, but he said the most important thing to be is a good ancestor. And so you step in and you do your work, and you open a different energetic dynamic for the whole family system. So that's what I'd suggest you work for, is toward, okay. Take the tools, start using them, and work toward the point where you can spend 2.4 hours a day doing your work.
Okay. All right, I'll do that. Thank you.
Awesome. And, you know, if you're working you're working during showtime, once the show is over, you can download the shows day by day and continue to listen. And we've actually got about 10 years in the archives. So there are 3,000 or 4,000 shows in our archives that you can go back and download. And the best app to see them in it that I've found, most apps where you do podcasts limit you to 300 shows. And the iHeartRadio app gives you access to all of our programs right back to day one over 10 years ago. You can download them free.
Wow.
And we're here to answer every question you can possibly come up with. You know, if you are on the phone with us every day, that would be awesome. You know, asking questions, refining, asking. That's what we're here for.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Cool.
I do appreciate it.
All right. Delight to meet you.
Same here.
All right,
take
blessings.
Care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
And we're down to the last minute or two. So everybody, thank you for participation and being with us, and create the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. And blessings. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio.
with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mindshifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.